Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, July 4th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
So are you going to announce that we're going to start a clothing line, you know, the shirts, the name of Larry shirt collection?
Yeah, we have to do this, in my opinion. Larry, now, I want to start with with July 4th. It's so important in the history of the United States. Let's start with that. Your take on the way that the United States, how do you feel about the United States today? And what is your take on the combination of this day and what the United States is today?
We've become the very thing that we were fighting against in the American Revolution. The American Revolution was an uprising against a colonial power. And it was, I think, the first colonial war that the Brits lost. I have 28 ancestors that fought in that war, most as militia. My fifth great uncle, Charles Thompson, he was the secretary of the Continental Congress. And, you know, his story sort of mirrors what, let's call it, what made America this land of opportunity for many and why it continues to attract migrants. Because he was 11 years old and had a 17-year-old brother, William, who's my fifth great-grandfather. And they were coming from Ireland, and their mother had died the previous year. And so they were with their father, and they're in sight of the U.S. shore, and their father dies. You know, I don't know, you know, how, what the sickness was. So when they land in Philadelphia, they are split up. The 17-year-old William is sent south into Virginia, where he becomes a farmer. And Charles gets taken in by a merchant. I forget which, he had a particular business, but anyway, that business led him into contact to Benjamin Franklin. And so Charles became a protege of Benjamin Franklin and grew up, became a lawyer. He taught Latin and Greek. But, you know, again, you go from being a 12-year-old immigrant on a boat and now an orphan to be able to rise to the point of where you are the person. He kept the Declaration of Independence in his possession for 15 years from the time it was signed in 1776 until the government was finally formed and settled, starting to set up shop in Washington, D.C. So my point in telling that story is we came out of wanting to throw off the chains of colonial oppression. But, you know, it was still, there was that dark chapter. We can't, you know, gloss over it, that slavery was still allowed. It was allowed in this country and practiced principally in the South. The attack on the Native Americans that were here well before the arrival of all these Europeans, that was a genocide. There's no other way to paint it. That's where, if you will, the United States started losing its soul. And yet we still, you know, we still kept this, you know, happy mythology, despite the Civil War and, you know, the 1860s, that we were, this was a land of opportunity where you weren't constrained by caste system, by, you know, it didn't matter what your last name was. It didn't matter whether your family was wealthy or not, that you could become successful. Now what we've come full circle that the United States is an enabler of colonial oppression. And we're seeing it both with the support for the Zionists, and we're seeing it, frankly, with the expansion of NATO and this threat that was presented to Russia. It's been, you know, growing for the last 30 years, and we've refused to acknowledge it. And then when you go around the world and look at the body counts. How many Afghans did we kill? How many Iraqis did we kill? How many Vietnamese did we kill? How many Cambodians died because of us? How many Libyans are dead? Syrians, how many of them are dead? So it's quite a horrific body count. It's not a, you know, we haven't been this, as Ronald Reagan liked to talk about it, you know, quoting Isaiah, a city on the hill, a light to the nations. Yeah, that we've always liked to believe that is what we're about, but what we've been is, you know, a curse to the nations by virtue of our imperialist attitudes. So I wouldn't, you know, if I was out doing this as a 4th of July speech, to be throwing stuff at me now, I'd say, throw hot dogs, not the rocks.
Larry, we had a phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And it seems that Donald Trump was not happy with the tone, with what Putin had to say to him. Here is what he said about the phone call and the way that he perceived it.
Ukraine, are you seeing Zelensky tomorrow? And what are you hoping?
I'm speaking to President Zelensky tomorrow, early in the morning. And yeah, I'm very disappointed with the conversation I had today with President Putin, because I don't think he's there. I don't think he's there. And I'm very disappointed. Well, it's not, I'm just saying, I don't think he's looking to stop. And that's too bad. This is Biden. This isn't me. This is Biden's war. It wouldn't have happened if I were president. It wouldn't have happened. So, you know, I in one way, I had to get too involved because it's Biden's war. And I got stuck in the middle of it, just like I did with immigration and a lot of other things that they screwed up. But I was not happy with the conversation, though.
Yeah. Oh, let's get out the handkerchief and dry his eyes. He's not happy. Oh, please. Look, this is, he's not telling the truth. And you know, first of all, I kept checking Truth Social. Did you see any posts on Truth Social complaining about his phone call with Vladimir Putin? I didn't.
No.
Okay, so that's tell number one, because if he was really unhappy with the phone call, he'd be blasting it out on Truth Social, you know, like what he was doing with the so-called supreme leader of Iran. You remember, you know, those guys, and, you know, unconditional surrender and all. Okay. Apparently, Putin's the one that initiated the phone call. Call him up and say, hey, want to wish you and the American people, actually, the call was yesterday, so the third, the American people, a happy 4th of July, you know, and reminded Trump of, hey, you know, Russia played an important role in the development of America in its early days. John Quincy Adams, who later became president, he was a U.S. ambassador to Russia, to the Tsarist court. And actually, he went there as a pretty young fellow, you know, when he was living in Europe, in the Netherlands with his father. So, you know, Putin made that point. Trump, the report, you know, had said 10 days ago that when he talked with Putin, and Putin offered to help with Iran, and basically Trump said, I don't need your damn help. You worry about yourself. That was his message. Trump intimated that, we talked briefly, but, you know, I told him we don't need his help. I don't think that's true at all. because the Russian readout, the Russians aren't going to lie and make something up on this. And they just said that a significant amount of the time of the conversation was devoted to the situation in Iran and the Middle East. And then they talked about Syria. I'm going, I thought Syria was part of the Middle East, but okay. So they separate, but the Russians separated it out. And so they had a detailed discussion about Iran. And, you know, I imagine one of those topics is, at least from the U.S. side, how do we get Iran back in the IAEA? You know, because they've now walked away. And the U.S. wants, the U.S. and Israel demanded, you got to get back in the IAEA. And Iran said, no, we're not going to do it, at least for right now. So I could see one of the details is Trump talking to Putin about, you know, maybe you could help us with this. And from Putin's standpoint, he wants to make sure that the conflict is contained because he recognizes how dangerous it is, both for Iran and for Israel, to be candid. Israel really is more at risk if this conflict, you know, if they start exchanging bombs and missiles again. Because Iran, I think Iran can actually bring Israel to its knees. Israel is just not big enough to sustain an attritional war. So they talked about that. And then, you know, they talked about the war. And Putin made it, just as he did with Macron in that conversation, he said, look, we're open to negotiations. We'll talk. But the root causes of this conflict have got to be addressed. That has to be settled. Well, that means NATO's got to stop its expansion. NATO needs to stop threatening. NATO needs to stand down, back off. That's the root cause right there. Western desire to use other countries as military proxies against Russia. And so the war is going to continue. And from the, you know, the Russian standpoint, they just, you know, they acknowledge that, you know, Trump heard what they said and what Putin said and didn't argue about it and didn't throw a tantrum and didn't make any threats. So Lord knows what he talked to Zelensky about today, because it probably has to do with will there be any future aid sent to Ukraine? The, you know, we've got some conflicting accounts. We got the announcement out of the Pentagon, a specific list of weapons, you know, 152 millimeter or 155 millimeter artillery shells, some Patriot missiles, I think even some launchers, some javelins, Hellfire, you know, a few other weapon systems. But then The Economist reported, no, it was a complete cutoff. Everything that was in the pipeline was shut down. That, you know, it could be that, you know, again, Trump's playing sort of a double game. He's pretending in his public statements, oh, I'm not happy with Russia. And boy, you know, and I'm talking to Zelensky. But behind the scenes, he said, okay, we're putting a stop to this now because one of Putin's demands is the Western aid to Ukraine needs to stop. So Trump's already taken, you know, if you're Russia, you view this, I don't care what Trump's saying in public. I'm watching, what is he doing? They've cut off the flow. Now, some suggested that, well, and the excuse was, well, because Israel may need this. Is Israel shooting 155 millimeter artillery shells? No. There's an error, you know, they need bombs. They need Patriot missiles, so you can make the case, okay, those Patriot missiles will be diverted to Israel. Of course, it's already been proven they don't work against the Iranian ballistic missiles, but hey. But, you know, the 155 millimeter shells, they don't, and the anti-tank guided missiles. Last I checked, Hamas is not driving around in tanks. So, you know, that suspension in aid, I think I had more to do with both sending a message to Ukraine, the war's over, as well as an acknowledgement that Western stockpiles in the United States are way down.
It seems that they had two plans. They had two plans on to convince Donald Trump to somehow put him in a better position in terms of the way that he's dealing with Iran and with Russia. Two attacks. One on Russia. They convinced him that they would show how vulnerable Russia is and maybe weaken the position of Russia by that attack on Russian nuclear bombers and all those attacks on those terrorist attacks with drones. And then came the situation with Iran. It seems that none of these two somehow fights, somehow conflicts, put Donald Trump in a better position to deal with any of these two countries. Because the situation with Israel is the way that Donald Trump simply says, I'm not going to help Ukraine because we have something, the priority of Israel. And Netanyahu, do you think that Netanyahu was the mastermind or the British government was the mastermind of these two plans? They helped Israel, Larry, for such a long time. Because if that was Netanyahu, I don't see Netanyahu alone going against Russia without the participation of the United Kingdom.
Well, yeah, no, I think Israel has been an invisible, up until recently, an invisible supporter of the whole war against Russia. You know, the whole history, if you will, of Russian Jews, Zionism, communism, it goes back quite a ways. You know, the henchmen for Joseph Stalin during the purges that took place in 1937-38, you know, a lot of killing going on. That was headed up by a Jewish guy. And remember, you know, Stalin's battle and ultimately execution or killing of Trotsky represented, because Trotsky's, again, Jewish, had this vision of this international communist revolution. And Stalin's position, as I understand it, he was worried about, hey, we got to take care of, we've got to get our own house together here in the Soviet Union. We can't be out stirring up, setting fires around the world. We got to put our own fires out here. And so that there was always that tension between the Jewish radicals and the Russians. So now here's Netanyahu. You know, his country, 20-25% of it are, you know, hold Russian passports, are, you know, Russian natives, Russian speakers. But I don't think they're there because they love Russia so much. They're in Israel because they don't like Russia necessarily. So, yeah, you can come up with a motive for why Israel would be collaborating with the Ukrainians. But again, the other ultimate irony is the neo-Nazi movement in Ukraine is, and it's found, it celebrates Stefan Bandera, and Bandera, who was aligned himself with the Nazis, with the Waffen-SS, in the extermination of Jews. They also killed a bunch of Poles and others. Is now, you know, come full circle where Israel is embracing the if you call it the ideological descendants of the people who tried to destroy their parents, grandparents, great grandparents. I don't think it was until June 13th that the Russians finally woke up and realized, hey, Israel is directly involved with this, because that decapitation strike that took place on June 13th in Tehran and across Iran was it had similar elements, particularly how the drones were launched and going at those airfields. So I think Israel has been definitely collaborating with MI6 and the United States. Let's not leave the U.S. out of this at all. The U.S. is just as complicit. And it is, you know, I think Russia now recognizes that the war with Iran, the war in Ukraine, what's going on with Azerbaijan, that it's facing a global threat from the West. The West is not letting up yet. The only thing is, the only way the West will let up is when it's been collapsed either militarily and or economically.
Here is, Larry, what Donald Trump said about Netanyahu's visit to the United States and the way he feels about the conflict in the aftermath.
Netanyahu about funding.
Oh, he's coming here. We're going to talk about a lot of things. We're going to talk about the great success we had. I mean, we had an incredible success in Iran. We had an incredible success, like really nobody's had in many, many years. That was a precision war strike. And the word obliteration can now be used because the Atomic Energy Commission said you can't even get into the place. It was demolished. It was really demolished. It's a great, brilliant strike. And how to go forward. We're also going to talk about Gaza. So we want to get the rest. We got a lot of hostages back, but we're going to talk about Gaza.
Larry, how do you find the way that Donald Trump is trying to picture the situation? And how much of what he said is the reality? How much of is with some sort of desire, some sort of perception on his part?
He's a used car salesman. You know, he will, he could pick up a piece of cow manure and spray it with gold paint and tell you it was solid gold. Now it's not. And, you know, he's undergone quite a change. You know, we tracked him over, you know, over those 12 days. You know, day number one, I know everything. I knew the minute it was going to happen. Oh, boy, because he'd been told. This is what Iran's going to do. They're going to decapitate. This is going to cause that Islamic regime to crumble, to collapse. And Israel's going to have a tremendous victory. And then it didn't happen. Iran picked itself up off the floor. It got knocked down. And within 14 hours, they had launched ballistic missiles at Israel, and Israel couldn't stop them. And it continued. There were 22 different waves of missile attacks over 12 days. You know, it was, someone said they're going to have to come up with another name because it was called, they called it True Promise 3.1, True Promise 3.2, got 3.22, you know. Israel was suffering. Not just suffering, it suffered severe damage. So the two ports were closed, not necessarily destroyed, but because of the missiles flying, the insurance company said, you go in there, you go at your own risk. We're not going to insure you. So that shut down maritime traffic coming into Israel. Their only international airport, Ben Gurion, shut down. Oil refineries shut down. And then with the missile, the nuclear facilities, the Department of Defense, the intelligence headquarters, their Unit 8200, all of these locations were hit. Now, we don't still have a good account of how much damage was done, but they were damaged. And then the report surfaced that, you know, Israel's running out of missiles, air defense missiles. They're going to be out in 2 weeks. And that wasn't hype. That was reality. So, and then now the reports are surfacing that Iran was prepping to mine the Straits of Hormuz. I'm still a little skeptical of that because I don't see them in a mood to want to hurt or alienate their allies in Asia. But I do think Iran was in a position to do a more selective blockade, just ships destined for Europe, or the United States would be stopped. But, you know, it was in the midst of that then that Trump goes from his, you know, jubilation the first day to, you know, within 36 hours, he goes, oh, I didn't know anything about this. I knew nothing. You know, so he went from knowing it all to knowing nothing. So, you know, he got out of it by, you know, putting on this show, you know, and they did attack Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. I have no doubts about that. But they did construct this narrative. Oh, we obliterated it. Well, we really don't. All we can see is the surface damage. And maybe they've got some intelligence collection of conversations between workers at the site, you know, calling back home saying, man, yeah, I'm up here working. This place is it's a wreck. You know, maybe they have something like that. But I do know that the intelligence community concluded before the strike by the B-2s that Iran had moved the enriched uranium, and we didn't know where it was. So this is quintessential Donald Trump, that everything he does is the greatest, the biggest, the most beautiful, the most wonderful. I really find it disturbing. It's just, you know, that's not normal mental functioning to talk that way. He's incapable of doing an accurate description. He's always selling. He's got to have the headlines. Read Alistair Crook's latest piece at Strategic Culture. He does a great job of explaining, taps into this author, Michael Wolff, who is in touch with a bunch of people that Trump has talked to. And Trump is always, he's a very insecure person. You think somebody with his wealth and accomplishments would be, have a lot thicker skin and not be so insecure, but very, very, very insecure, which is why he goes overboard to tell you how great he is and how wonderful he is. And everything he does is just the best and there's nothing better. You know, that's a mark of a person who inside is, you know, has no sense of self-worth. It's pretty sad, actually.
Yeah. Here is what he said, Larry, about the attack on Iran and the response from Iran.
Just the other day, where the missiles are being shot down one after another. You know, they called me to tell me they have to take a shot at us. This was Iran, very respectful. That means they respect us. Because we dropped 14 bombs, they said, we'd like to take 14 shots at you. I said, go ahead, I understand. Can you imagine? They were nice enough. This is Iran, to call me and tell me that they would like to shoot me at 14 times. So they want to shoot us, and I said, go ahead, and they shot 14 high-grade, very fast missiles.
Do you understand what he wants to achieve by describing this way?
Me. They called me. They're nice. They had to talk to me. It's about me. I mean, look, Trump is not the only narcissist to have ever served in the White House. I mean, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton. It's like narcissist lineup. But, you know, Trump really does take it to another level. And, instead of admitting what had actually happened was Israel was a genuine risk of losing the war to a point that the government would have collapsed, that state of Israel would have been in disarray because they could not continue to live like this. You know, at some point they were going to be run into fuel shortages and food shortages. And then, with the inability of ships to come into port and offload food, you know, it was going to create an existential threat for Israel. Now, faced with that existential threat, then there's the possibility of the Samson option of them, you know, wanting to use a nuke, which may have been one consideration for Iran and saying, okay, we'll agree to stop hitting you. But it was the Israelis that went to Trump said, you know, basically get us out of this. I mean, even Ben Gavir admitted, Iran was a tougher target than they thought, that they didn't realize Iran had the capabilities Iran did. And my understanding is that Iran didn't use its most advanced, solid fuel missiles. They used some of the older stuff. It was still quite effective at penetrating Israeli air defense. It was an appropriate ceasefire. I did have one of the readers of my blog at sonar21.com. He's a Native American converted to Shia Islam. And he wrote a pretty good explanation of sort of some of the religious thinking that went into a lot of what Iran did, and pointed out, he says, you know, under the guidance of the Ayatollah, Iran's not going to launch preemptive strikes. They will only strike back if struck. And similarly, to avoid killing civilians as much as possible. So, Iran agreed. Once Israel stopped, Iran stopped. Now, I don't think they're gonna, maintain the ceasefire, I guess is the best way to say it. I think they're going to attack again. They're going to look for a pretext. And I cannot rule out a false flag attack that will be blamed on Iran, that Iran had nothing to do with, that will be used as further justification for the United States to attack Israel again. But, you know, we're going to find out that just as the United States demonstrated in the Red Sea with the Houthis, we no longer have the ability to sustain a war that's going to last more than a day or two. It's just, it's too expensive. And the logistics trail, you know, you look at what was required to put those six B-2 bombers over Fordo, because normally when they're fully fueled, they can only carry one bomb to take off, those GBU-57s. But they almost, the fuel tanks were almost empty. They had enough fuel to take off and fly for, say, 10 or 15 minutes, carrying two of those bombs. And once they got airborne, then they were refueled immediately. But, the United States, if its goal was to stop the Iranian nuclear program from moving towards building a nuclear bomb, that was the goal. It failed, completely failed, because what they did was when the Israelis killed some of those top military leaders, my understanding is that some of those guys were actually the ones encouraging finding rapprochement with the West. Now there are some, let's call them the hardliners, who said, you know, you can't trust the West. We're going to have to, you know, we'll have to defend ourselves, and we'll be prepared to strike them hard. So right away, you've got people now in positions of decision making that are going to be much more difficult to deal with, and maybe less inclined to even engage or entertain the possibility of diplomacy or negotiation. And we don't know where the enriched uranium is. And Iran reportedly has another secret nuclear site where they can process and enrich uranium. So this, as I said all along, this was not about Iran getting a nuke. That was the excuse. This is about the regime change, because the broader plan is we've got to do something to prevent China from becoming the global leader in economic power. That is the ultimate target. That's what's got to be stopped. To do that, we need to break Russia off from China and to weaken Russia so Russia can't come to China's aid. So we got to take Russia out first. But to get rid of Russia, we need to attack it from the south, which is why color revolution attempts in Georgia, color revolution attempts in Azerbaijan, now working clearly, directly with Western intelligence and with the Israelis in carrying out this attack, and also causing disruption in Armenia. So the West is meddling in all of these areas, and for one reason alone, which is to ultimately set the stage for destroying China. But, you know, Russia is one of the stepping stones in that, and Iran is one of the big chess pieces on that board.
The situation with Azerbaijan, Larry, I cannot imagine that Turkey was not aware. They didn't know about what's going on in Azerbaijan, and they had to know about it.
Wait a second. Are you suggesting that Erdogan is not trustworthy? Oh, my God. Breaking news. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Because the reason I'm mentioning this, Larry, is because when you come to Azerbaijan, it's somehow different from Georgia, because Azerbaijan is under the influence, direct influence of Turkey and Erdogan. Yeah. And yeah, here comes the influence of the British intelligence and Erdogan coming together to go against both targets, Russia and Iran.
Yeah, you know, Erdogan wants to be the big man in the world. He wants to be the new Sultan, you know. And, you know, he plays a duplicitous game. He is Mr. Perfidy embodied. You know, he is a schemer. He is dishonest. And, you know, he'll happily eat with the devil. You know, that's why he continues to provide oil to Israel, even though he claims to be a man of Islam. You know, while the Israeli, the Zionists are killing Palestinians, here's Erdogan enabling it. So, yeah, no, absolutely. I think they're collaborating, conspiring, however you want to put it. And, you know, Russia recognizes that as a threat. It is Azerbaijan, though, is not in as strong a position to really to take on Russia at all. And, you know, if necessary, Russia will quash it. And, you know, the world will be outraged and they'll want to sanction Putin. Listen, if you got rats that come into your house, you got to kill those rats, get rid of them. You don't say, oh, we'll just have to ignore them. And that's the situation right now. It was pretty tense, you know, a couple of days ago. It does seem that the tensions have cooled off, or that, you know, there are efforts to, you know, tamp it down in Azerbaijan. Because I think the Russians still have some elements of support there in the country. Of course, you know, it makes it more likely that when the helicopter of the Iranian president Raisi went down, that it was probably sabotaged in Azerbaijan, whether Azerbaijan or Mossad. But that was really the start. You know, some of us were willing to get the benefit of the doubt. I look back now and say, no, that was the start of this attack on Iran, you know, expanding the attack, stepping it up.
Larry, because Azerbaijan is part of the project between North-South corridor, between Russia goes to Azerbaijan, Iran, and then goes. But why they're behaving this way if they're going to benefit from a project that is big, that is important, or I would argue for Azerbaijan as well, because they're part of the project. And how do you see the role of the British government, the British intelligence in Azerbaijan? Are they really involved? Because there they have a refinery. Recently, I found that they have a refinery in Ukraine. How? Why do they need to do? How is that?
Yeah,
you know, somehow everything can be connected. These are points that you connect them together,
yeah,
and you have a bigger picture of what's going on.
Well, my understanding is that the CIA has a large presence in Azerbaijan, and that operations are run throughout the region, just extending through all of the stands, you know, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. But that's sort of the center of operations for that whole regional effort is in Azerbaijan. The Mossad has a significant presence in Azerbaijan, as do the Brits. So the efforts have been to cultivate sources and money paid to individuals, as well as creating economic opportunities in the West for these people, for the very specific purpose of sabotaging Russia's desire for that north-south economic corridor. What's sort of ironic in all of this is, you know, the Azeris are Shia, largely. You know, there are a few Sunnis, but they're largely Shia. So you would think that they would be at least theologically in sync with Iran, but they're not. And I think it goes back because the Azeris are more Turkish ethnically as opposed to Persian. So, you know, centuries of history are still affecting how people get along or don't get along. But yeah, it's, you know, it really wasn't seen as much of an issue 6 months ago, but you know, it's actually a major issue now. But it looks like Russia is taking steps to deal with it. And, you know, I think, again, in tandem with this is what's happening in Armenia as well. Yeah. So, you know, the conflict there, you know, Muslim versus Christian, basically. And now the Pashinyan, the president of Armenia, is attacking the Christian church. The Armenian Christian church is, I understand, the oldest Christian church in the world, as far as, you know, tracing its roots back to second century, third century, somewhere in there. So, you know, Russia's got more to worry about than just finishing off Ukraine, which they're doing. So, but it's also, you know, having to look at this whole strategic picture as the West is coming at its underbelly, you know, and despite, you know, trying to work out a friendly relationship with Donald Trump, this whole intelligence apparatus is still out there, working on its own. They're not. Trump does. I don't think Trump has a clue about the other policies in place that are driving this.
Sometimes I doubt if Donald Trump is receiving precise and accurate information from the intelligence. I don't see that coming to the president, Larry, because look at what has happened. We were talking about these two attacks even before happening, and you mentioned that if Donald Trump decides to escalate the situation in Ukraine, if he tries to go against Iran and the war, yeah, that would hugely damage his picture, his administration's picture, in order to make America great again, if that's the final goal on their part. But even with those attacks, and they have failed totally, you don't see the sanity coming to the administration. You don't see they're getting everything the way that we see, the way that was the real outcome of these two conflicts. It's somehow they feel that they can somehow continue in some sort of manner in other types. They can, yeah, twist it, they can change it, change the face, but still the main goal remains intact.
Well, Actually, I think we've got some insight into Donald Trump's relationship with the intelligence community. He's ignoring the intelligence community. Now, so let's break it out. First, you've got Tulsi Gabbard as the DNI, where she presented what was the collective judgment of the intelligence community about Iran's nuclear program. If the question was, does Iran have the technical skill and to build a nuclear bomb? Absolutely, they do. If they made the decision to do it. Do they currently have quantities of enriched uranium that would allow them to create a nuclear bomb? No, but if they decided to do so, they could get it. Have they made a decision to build a nuke? The answer there was no. And while I have not seen the classified material behind this, just based upon my prior experience, I suspect that one of the reasons they were so confident and have been confident since 2003, 2004, that Iran is not building a nuke, is that one, because of the Western intelligence penetrated the IAEA. So not only were the IAEA inspectors doing the normal inspections, but there were, let's call them spies, personnel attached to those that outfit that was providing clandestine secret information back to Mossad, to the CIA, to French intelligence, or to MI6, about what was actually going on. And they were interacting with these nuclear scientists. They also could identify who they were. But so you had that information. You had probably signal intelligence, where conversations between different personnel, maybe in the intelligence service or military service in Iran, were admitting that, yeah, no, we're not building a nuke. So the point was, they had solid intelligence on this. This wasn't just a bunch of people sitting around saying, what do you think? Oh, I think they will. I think that, you know, no, it was a judgment based on intelligence. Well, what did Trump do with that? He wiped his ass with it. Yeah, I don't care what they say. They're getting a nuke, because he was accepting what the Israelis were telling him. Now, I think on this particular issue, the intelligence community was providing reliable information that Trump was ignoring, refusing to listen. That message gets passed down. What analyst who wants to get promoted, who wants to get a good evaluation, is going to challenge the president who says that, no, what you're saying is wrong? Even though I said, well, I can show you all this evidence. No. The president says you're wrong, so don't rock the boat. Then we have the situation with the intelligence that's being provided on Ukraine and Russia. There, the intelligence community is just lying its ass off. They're not. Thomas Massie recently spoke about, he was in on a briefing about the state of the war in Ukraine, and it was entirely one-sided, talking about, oh, yeah, there are all these Russian casualties. Not a word about Ukraine's casualties. And again, just from a simple analytical standpoint, if Russia's firing 23 artillery shells for every one that Ukraine's firing, who's going to suffer more casualties? If Russia is launching 20 more drones than Ukraine is launching, who's going to suffer more casualties? I mean, it's just, you know, let's start with those. Those are facts. And what was clear for Massey is these intelligence analysts came in and lied. They lied about when the judge played a clip of Senator John Kennedy talking about, Iran is just days away from having a bomb. And that was the best briefing ever, but he wouldn't admit what the sourcing of it was. Well, it was Israeli sourcing. I had a conversation yesterday with a friend who had spoken to a member of the U.S. Senate and a member of the House of Representatives. They're both from the same state. And both admitted that they were saying, we've just been briefed that the head of Iran's drone program is somewhere in the United States. We don't know where, and they're preparing to launch.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, they were dead ass serious. We're talking a U.S. senator and a member of Congress, the House of Representatives. Oh, yeah, the Iranians are coming to get us. So I can't rule out the high likelihood of a Israeli false flag being carried out and making it appear to be that it was an Iranian attack in order to justify further military action. But if Israel's dumb enough to do that, they are going to regret it, because I think Iran will then bring down that regime.
Larry, how Mossad is capable to provide the president of the United States with information? Are they going to provide it to the intelligence in the United States, or they have their line of communication directly with the president?
Well, no, it's both. I mean, so CIA and MI6, they have a liaison. You know, they're called liaison officers, and there's information that we'll share with Israel, and Israel will share with us. More often than not, you know, I always call that intelligence with a purpose, because Israel's always going to give you information that suits their agenda and serves their interests. The question is, when that information is included, say, in material brief to the president, is it clearly identified as this is from an Israeli source, or this is information from Israel, or is it presented as if it was somehow collected more objectively? Israel will have. It's not so much Mossad having direct access, but people like Netanyahu and other key members of his government will have, you know, they've got friends and contacts through Marco Rubio and Susie Wiles, the president's chief of staff.
If you mentioned if Israel decides to attack Iran, do you find that Donald Trump would be in a position to help them? He said the way that he was talking about Netanyahu and his visit to the United States, said the attack on Iran was so much successful, they even can't verify what has happened to those sites because it's all broken, it's all damaged, destroyed, obliterated, right, as he mentioned. I don't see Donald Trump being somehow, he's not willing to attack Iran. He's not willing to go in that direction, because the way that he's picturing, whatever is the reality, whatever he's in his mind and he's picturing the situation, that shows to us that he doesn't want a broader, a bigger war with Iran. What's your take on this? And many people are talking about that in Iraq, the United States is just moving weapons into Iraq, and they're bringing some sort of new weapons in Iraq. I don't see the United States using Iraq because it's somehow just so too close to Iran.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the history with the United States meddling in Iraq, it goes back 46 years, or before that. You know, we basically helped install Saddam Hussein in power, and then with the fall of the Shah of Iran, we again saw Iraq as a hammer to be used against the Iranian people, and we're active, you know, supplying the chemical weapons to Iraq that they used against the Iranians. And, you know, so this, you know, long history. And then, you know, the 2003 to overthrow Saddam Hussein to install the Shias in power. But there was the actual belief that they would be against Iran. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. So I hope you're right that Trump is not going to fall into the trap of attacking Iran again. But I can't rule it out. You know, he's really not, you know, he's not thinking about this strategically. He thinks he's emotional, and he's very short term. So, you know, like you've seen the wide swings in personality from, oh yeah, we're winning, I knew everything, to, oh, I don't know anything. No. And it's always, this is the worst, this is the best. So, you know, he doesn't have any sort of moderate middle ground there. And what you're talking about is a moderate middle ground. I'm not sure. So, yeah, if there is a false flag, then he will launch new military strikes on Iran, and it remains to be seen. Will Iran be better prepared and equipped this time to fight back? Because, you know, if he's going to attack Iran again, and then, you know, Iran goes through another one of these kabuki theaters where, okay, hey, we're going to hit, you know, we're going to hit your base. You know, it's going to be a proportional response so that we can save face. And then we'll stop. We'll no longer continue our attacks against Israel as long as they stop attacking us. You know, that was the deal. You know, and Trump went along with that because he, you know, at least he realized at that point Israel was in big trouble. But do you think that's going to be at the top of his mind if there's this perceived terrorist attack by Iran in the United States, you know, especially today on July 4th, that he would not immediately, I mean, he'd be under such enormous political pressure to strike. We've got to destroy those Iranians. And nobody would want to listen to the fact that it wasn't Iran. But, you know, facts don't matter when you're dealing with this kind of emotion.
I talked with Larry Andre Martianov. He said that we know from the sources that Iran has received fighter jets from Russia, Su-35, and there are more than two, and nobody knows how many fighter jets Iran received. But we haven't seen anything. We haven't heard anything about fighter jets, Iran using fighter jets against Israel, or maybe going above the Iranian airspace to just protect Iran.
Yeah.
What can we say about that? What can we get with this sort of... And you've mentioned Iran didn't use maybe the high quality and more the more sophisticated missiles they possess, yeah. They have. And with the case of fighter jets, what's your take on the way that Iran behaved during these 12 days of war?
Well, their air force appeared to be largely irrelevant during those 12 days. I know that if they did get Su-35s just recently from Russia, I don't know if the pilots have actually been trained, you know, or if they've been training for the last year and a half. You know, my understanding,
it seems that they've received them in January, Larry, as Andre pointed out.
Okay. And again, I have no, they were not a factor in the 12-day war. And, you know, Iran has a problem with its air defense. A lot of it was suppressed by cyber attacks, but also it was attacked on the ground by people recruited by Mossad. They did use some of the anti-tank guided missiles, I understand, to take out some of the sites. So Iran's first task ought to be right now rebuilding and bolstering its air defense system. and to counter the measures that were used by the West against it. You know, when you look back to the attack on October 27th by Israel, that Iran did a pretty effective job of fending it off and minimizing damage. But Israel used that, as did the United States, as a way to collect intelligence on the Iranian systems that were in play. And then they devised countermeasures to render those systems ineffective. And that was what was applied on June 13th. And then throughout the course of the war, that Iran's air defense system was functioning as poorly as Israel's was. The only advantage was Israel's not sitting on thousands of ballistic missiles, which I believe Iran is. And my basis for that is, my understanding is, Iran builds the missiles underground. They're not being built above ground in a factory that can be easily located and destroyed. And the missiles are stored underground in extensive, well-protected caves. So, Iran has a definite advantage on that front. But, we'll see if it, if on the shopping list, I would think the SU-35 would be one of the last items. You'd want S-400s. You'd want electronic warfare. You'd want advanced radar systems. Those, from a defensive standpoint.
Larry, do we know what is the differences between the Chinese fighter jets that they were used during the conflict between Pakistan and India, and the fighter jets that Israel is using?
No, I'm not really an expert on that. I suspect that many of the parts that are in the Chinese jet came from the United States. Russia right now is the only one that has developed the ability to build an aircraft, a combat aircraft, or a commercial jetliner for that matter, with all items manufactured in Russia, so that they're not at all, not even, no software, no other items coming out of the United States. So I don't know what vulnerabilities that creates on the Chinese jets. Just as Americans worry about Chinese doing backdoor software to get into systems, the United States has that capability too, and I don't know if any of the flight systems that are in the combat jet originated in the United States.
The decision not to send weapons to Ukraine is a decision on the part of Pete Hegseth, or the administration has decided about
it? Oh, yeah. He did that in consultation with Trump. Hegseth didn't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to cut it off. No. This was, I think Trump he's trying to fool people into believing that he hasn't really made a tough decision, that he's still, I'm still unhappy with Putin. But the real decision's been made. We're going to stop supplying weapons. We're going to show the Russians that we're serious. It's because one of Putin's demands is the West has to stop supplying weapons and intelligence to Ukraine. So the United States effectively did that even before Putin called. And, I think this is, in a sense, this is a game that Trump is playing. And, let the word out, this is Hegseth, just so that Trump doesn't get jammed up politically. Now, with the passage of the big, beautiful bill, I think Trump now has more legislative flexibility. He is, before he couldn't risk doing some foreign policy initiatives that might anger some of the Republican base that is pro-war. So, he kept made that a gray area. Now we'll see. Now he might now be able to, it would be nice to rein in Bibi Netanyahu, because he's not having to round up votes on the Hill to pass the big, beautiful bill. He is, you know, one other thing, a little unrelated, but he is going to run into some, I think, some fairly significant economic problems as a result of his tariff policy. I was talking with one of my neighbors yesterday. We had a gathering at his home, and he's actually in business importing sports items like baseball bats, lacrosse sticks, other things. He said that the Trump tariffs have cost him $150,000 already, and he said that wasn't in our budget. Now he's not a multi-million dollar company, but he was pointing out that he's going to have to raise prices on an item that would normally sell for, let's say, $50. He's going to have to raise prices on it by $25. So he told me, it's really slowing us down. This is slowing down the economy. So, up to this point, Trump's been bragging, see, my tariffs are bringing in all this money. Well, maybe bringing money to the U.S. Treasury, but it's taking money out of the pockets of American small businesses. And that economic problem is going to end up being a further distraction for him down the line.
Is he going to, this time that he has decided not to send weapons to Ukraine, is he going to be able to convince the United Kingdom? It seems that France somehow knows what's going on, knows what's, after all, what's going to happen. But I don't see the United Kingdom going with the plan on the part of the United States. Here is what UK Defense Secretary John Healey said.
And I announced that we would increase to £4 billion in this Parliament the investment that we make in autonomy in drones. That's more than double that was in the budget before. It's largely capital expenditure, and we will learn the lessons from Ukraine in being able to develop not just better and produce more drones for Ukraine, which we will do this year. We will increase by at least tenfold the drones that we supply to Ukraine this year. But
guess who's going to be part of this drone production in Ukraine? Belgium and Turkey.
Yeah.
Going to be.
Yeah, say again, Turkey right there is, Erdogan has made a terrible mistake with that, because now he has fully aligned with Ukraine, and Ukraine's going to lose. And Putin won't forget. The Russians won't forget. Putin might be willing to be a little more conciliatory, but Medvedev and others will not. Turkey's aligned itself. This is like that expression, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Yeah. It's got a hole in the side, it's sinking, and you're worrying about where to sit and how to arrange the chairs. Yeah, good luck, because in a few months, that ship's going to be gone. It'll be underwater. So, have at it, guys. Go ahead, build up your drone program. For what? If you're going to actually do drone production in Ukraine, Russia's going to destroy it. It's delusional thinking is what it is. Putin last week, or earlier this week in Minsk, at a press conference where he announced that, he says, next year we will start reducing defense spending. I think that is Putin signaling he fully believes that this war in Ukraine is coming to an end. And I just heard that Budinov, the Ukrainian intelligence chief, who's reportedly close with the CIA, he was criticizing Ukrainians for believing. He says, if you think you're ever going to recover any of the land that Russia has taken, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. And Russia's going to keep moving forward and will retain whatever land it takes. You know, some actually sane, rational thinking by Budanov. So this is, I think the end game has started for this. And with Putin saying that the other day, he wasn't trying to make what I'd call a Trumpian boast. I think he's making, because he tends to be far more cautious. But it was clear that next year, Russia is going to be shifting out of its vast defense spending and focus more on domestic items, in theory. We'll see what happens with Azerbaijan and Turkey.
Are Odessa and Nikolaev going to be part of cordon sanitaire or the buffer zone, or yeah, they're going to be part of Russia at the end?
Part of Russia. Yeah, but I don't think Russia is going to take back Odessa and Mykolaiv. Yeah, like I said, I think all territory that's east of the Dnieper River will be under Russia control. And there's not a thing that Ukraine can do to stop it.
The western part of Ukraine, Larry, do you feel that would be an oblast, something like a province, oblast, and something like that to be governed, but by a governor, not a president? Or how is that going? What's going to happen to them?
There's even come up with several scenarios that either the existing Ukrainian government, you know, they do have new elections, they elect somebody who's maybe more appealing to the Ukrainians than Zelensky is. But you can't rule out that Poland and Romania and Hungary are going to be taking chunks of Ukraine for themselves, or reincorporating areas in Ukraine that once were part of their territory of those countries. So it's going to be a recipe for political chaos. That's the one thing we can bet on. And it'll be chaotic because Ukraine will lose the access it has to the Black Sea.
Yeah.
And that'll be devastating for it.
They're done, Larry. The economy has been destroyed. I don't know who's going to manage this situation. I don't see even Europeans being willing to help them to somehow. Do you feel that they're going to be part of EU? They're going to be, or they're much of a problem, a bigger problem for the EU that they cannot sustain?
No, they won't be. They'll never be part of the EU for another reason, that as long as the EU is constituted as it is currently, bringing Ukraine in would be seen as an attack, a threat on farmers in France and Poland and some other countries. So that would just create too much political pressure. But remember, earlier this week, Lavrov, Medvedev, and Putin, they've all signaled previously they didn't take a position about Ukraine joining NATO. Now they're saying hell no, because or joining the EU, because now they say the EU is just an appendage of NATO. So it's just as much of a threat.
Just to wrap up this session, Larry, I want to play a clip of NATO Secretary General somehow talking about Lavrov. Here is what
I've seen this. God.
Also need to pay for this, for building up NATO further, because we know the Russia threat is there. And then to Lavrov, I mean, he's foreign minister of Russia, I think, since the birth of Jesus Christ. And since then, anything useful came out of his mouth. So let's not pay too much attention to Mr. Lavrov.
So how do you feel about...
He's not happy with Lavrov.
You know,
the only reasonable guy in the scene is Lavrov. And he's...
Ruta certified himself as an imbecile. a man of such limited intelligence that so he gets along with being boot-licking, ass-kissing, sycophant. He's an imbecile. And, you know, that's the Secretary General. You know, he couldn't lead thirsty cows to water, you know. So,
but the guy is not boring at all.
Oh yeah, no. Hey, great
making news.
great entertainment value,
Daddy.
But you know, insulting Lavrov like that, I got to wonder what was it that Lavrov said that triggered him, and maybe it was Lavrov's comment that they view the EU as just an appendage of NATO, and that's no longer going to be acceptable to Russia. That Ukraine will never join the EU.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
My pleasure, as always. We'll see you on Monday. Can't wait to see what shirt you're going to show up in.
I do as
All right, my friend. Take care.
See you soon, Larry. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Take care.